Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.
Around voices, and we thought of the stuttering voice. Thought of the stuttering voice on the pig. There had been some comedians that were popular, you know, with a stuttering voice in those days that you don't see so much now, although there's a new guy doing it now. So anyway, that film was made, and it went out, and it went over real good. Leon was really tickled, you know, my God, his idea to have a gang, and my God, it went over. So then he ordered now that the Looney Tunes should star the gang. So Buddy was out, and the Looney Tunes at that time said Looney Tunes, and then it had Porky and Beans and Kitty and Oliver around the rim, you know, on the main title. So we were off and running with that. Then, of course, you know, over a period of time, we developed Porky into a cuter guy like that, and that's more of the way he looked then, mm-hmm. from the too fat. Our gang type guy. Now, about that time, it was shortly after the Porky thing took off, that Leon hired Tex Avery. This is a drawing made by one of the guys in the studio. And he hired Tex away from Walter Lantz. And Tex hadn't directed yet, but he had an ambition to be a director, and he had a lot of good ideas. And so Leon hired him, and then he called me and says, I'm going to put you with Tex to assist him, you know, help him on the gags and the layouts, and you know how our characters are supposed to look and so forth. So the morning that we walked out of Leon's office to go over to this little building that we're going to do him in, which became Termite Terrace, one of the artists looking out the window, and at noontime he brought me this sketch that he'd made of us, and I kind of treasured that. So anyway, over at Termite Terrace, we had a wonderful spirit over there. We were kind of outcasts. The main studio wanted us to fail. You see, there was two units over there, the Frizz and the other unit.
Yeah.
And this here was an upstart unit, and they were hoping we'd fail. We were over there working day and night. And so anyway, with Tex leading the thing and me throwing gags and so forth, we started getting funnier pictures. One of the cartoons we started in Termite Terrace was called Porky's Duck Hunt. Tex had the idea that we should do a duck hunt picture. And anyway, out of those gags, we developed this crazy duck. And I animated the first scenes of him where he'd jump off and go around the lake crazy.
Bounce
on his head.
That's great. You see that quite often.
Yes.
I watch for it.
Right.
Because I watch cartoons, you know.
Yes.
And, in fact, I even have two TVs set up so I can watch Channel 13 and Channel 11.
Together.
Yeah.
Same time. Good.
Sure.
Yeah.
And they go for 2 hours at a time and do the same thing in the morning. So, you know, I'm doing this book. It's great reference for me, you know. Really.
And hopefully a little bit of seeing what you see now will put some of the stuff in perspective, you know. There were different periods of improvement where you went from this to this.
Yeah, I take quite a few of these.
Yeah. Well, that, when I look at that thing I did at the time, the first one, I had him do a ballet spin, you know, like you jump a pirouette and on his jump bounce on his head and so forth. This was a Keystone Cop type of leap.
See, there was a lot of freeness going on then, a lot of craziness, because Woody Woodpecker was happening at the same time. No, not yet.
Several years later,
Okay, well, even when he began, he was crazy as a Looney Tune. And, you know, they eventually got kinder and kinder and kinder and kinder.
And duller. And sometimes duller.
Yeah. Duller is right.
Right. Actually, I think you'll find, if you research it, I think you'll find it was the success of first Daffy and then of Bugs, who also did some crazy things, that really started the trend, and Woody did a very nice, became a real nice third character of that type. Now, this is actually original drawing from the scene. We didn't actually have the woos till later. In other words, after we saw the pencil test of this action that was so wild, then we thought, hey, it's got to have some sound or music or something to match the wildness, and that was when the woo thing came. Then, of course, a couple of years later, we had sort of refined Daffy to this. Years later, he was refined even to a further degree. Now, the Bugs Bunny thing started and developed over several years' period of time. But when we're getting close to the final one, when Tex was making Wild Hair, and right about in that period, Bob Givens and I worked on a model sheet. And this was the, you'll see it, no, it was Bugs Bunny model sheet number one, meaning of this version. Mm-hmm. And I gave this to a friend at the time, a young cartoonist who was showing great interest. And he was so crazy about the rabbit that I gave it to him, and he still has it framed. But anyway, I'll show you an interesting thing.
Lucky guy.
Yeah, you know, I...
It's nice to have.
Since it wasn't the one we used, I would have saved it otherwise, but I thought, well, it's such an old family friend, and they've been so good to me. His father was the guy that did all the special effects on the Laurel and Hardy's and Hal Roach. You remember that picture where everything was invisible and all that?
Mm-hmm.
He won an Oscar, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, but I want to show you something here that's kind of interesting. You'll see here this sheet, and then you'll see the improvements we made, like this body is too long here, or he looks too mean most of the time.
Yeah,
you see,
yeah,
now watch, here's the one we made right after that. Mm-hmm. Now see the difference here, even though he frowns, you see it's a different. So this is the one that we made up, and that became the first official model sheet. And then, of course, Bugs became the greatest star. Everybody contributed to the making of the pictures. This, back about 1942, was the outside the Leon's office. This Leon's office, that's the entrance to the studio, which is now KTLA, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this was my particular unit of guys. Bob McKimson just passed on. It's a shame that, you know, that you didn't get a chance to talk to him. You'll talk to the others, but Cornette Wood here is still alive, and he worked on Fantasia later.
Mm-hmm.
Or, no, just before that, he worked on Fantasia.
You're holding the same one you have in your office?
That's the one, yeah. That's the very first statue of Bugs ever made. We used to use it, actually.
See, now, that's the kind of thing I would like in my book. That's, you know, because I can come over someday
get
with a professional photographer,
yeah,
and we could just set up a little screen area and take an hour,
sure,
or two and photograph certain things, because I like that boat,
yes,
that big boat you have too.
Yes.
I want to get a picture of that.
Right.
I think it would be fun just to have,
we
see, because that's something I'm going to have
day,
all the way through the book.
Yeah.
Just the products that were turned out, you know, like Casper, for instance. Do you know that I have 12 Caspers at home?
12,
Casper the Friendly Ghost.
Have you really?
Know, just to give you an idea,
yeah,
of all of the stuff I got.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
I think that would be of extreme interest, and most people miss that. See,
yeah,
you're into that end.
They don't realize it.
Don't realize it, no. And a kind of interesting thing I'll show you at the time is the way we would use that for the animator to see how he looked, say, if you're looking down from a tree onto him.
Mm-hmm.
Say a bird in a tree, and he's looking down, and he sees him, or if he's walking away from the camera. They'd actually sketch right from that, you see.
This particular picture I really like.
Now, there's an awful good guy here that you might be want to talk to. He was just starting then, and that's Bill Melendez. See him peeking over my shoulder there? Those are the Peanuts cartoons that he's done.
Those, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Now,
Charles Schultz, he's not, I'm sorry to keep doing this to you, but it helps me. Now he's back, he's up north.
Up north, yeah. I have his address. If
yeah, that would be helpful to me.
Sure. And he's, you know, it'd almost be worth the trip up there to go to his place where he does
sure
his
would.
Work
I,
and all, of, all the merchandise. And,
yeah. I'd love it.
Right. If you like, I'll give you a letter of introduction to him.
That would be super.
You know,
if you could do that,
yeah,
that'd be so nice.
When Sody and I were in Honolulu and spoke there to a large group on cartoons, and afterwards they came up and they gave me a beautiful Snoopy insignia that they had made for their local scout troop, you know. And this is their way of
mm-hmm.
giving me a gift. When I got it back, I said to them, I said, well, this really belongs to Charles Schultz. So when I got back, I sent it to him, and he really got a kick getting that. He has quite a collection of things.
That's probably the biggest phenomena, I think, since Mickey Mouse. I mean, the Peanuts.
It sure is.
Because that's, I don't get all the Peanuts stuff I see, because if I were to, Not too big of a load.
You know what? Well, you see it all over Europe. Peanuts are just all over Europe.
It's been on the stores.
Yeah. No. Right. And now, okay, here also is a fellow that's alive, but he's back in the East, Mike Sasanoff. He was a wonderful artist that laid out my backgrounds. And he became almost like my right-hand guy, you know, assistant. He'd go out when I want to work on story at night by myself, and I'd say, hey, Mike, you want to go with me? He wasn't that much of a story man, but he was a great guy to be humorous with. And he worked any night.
Bounce off ideas with.
Right. Yeah. And so we'd go off night after night and work on the stories, because sometimes the guys that were paid to be writers, you know, they worked hard all day and they didn't want it, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't going as well as it should. So I thought a lot about Mike. I think he's quite a guy. Okay. This now here's the shot of the same statue you see today.
I didn't see the beanie head.
Yeah, that's for the life size dummy.
Huh.
You know, for we made up a dummy. I'll show you this. That's the mold, actually.
Yeah.
Paul, I'll show you that. This was another character that I introduced at Warner's called Beaky Buzzard, which of course was based on Mortimer Snerd, you know, Bergen's Mortimer Snerd.
Which way did he go?
He was kind of a guy who was back all the time reluctantly. No, I don't want to know. No.
Yeah.
Let's hear you do the voice. You do it pretty good.
Oh, I don't remember what he said.
Yeah.
I think I remember him saying, which way did he go?
Yeah, that was also, way, you know? Also that Lenny Dog did that. It was like the...
Oh, was that?
Because
I remember that.
But we used the line on a lot of places, you see. Yeah. Now, this really came about because I had worked with Bergen a few years earlier, you see. Mm-hmm. And then he was making some shorts for Warner's with Charlie and Mortimer in them. And so actually I got a hold then of the Mortimer shorts and ran them with the animators. Mm-hmm. We really got some of his characteristics down pretty good. And one time I think I had Bergen come over with Mortimer and just to show it, just to do a few things for the animators. They got a big charge out of it. Then I made the first Tweety cartoon, and that's the way he looked. That was actually the first color drawing ever made of him. Huh. It was just made for the wall, you see. But he had the blue eyes then, even though we couldn't always carry it in the detail.
It's in this room.
It's in the next room, yeah. And that's, I think Sody found that just away in the storehouse, just all rolled up, a little piece of paper. And, and she surprised me by having it framed like this, and it's been on the wall ever since. And of course, you can see the refinement on him from that to that. This was a couple of photos taken by the Warner Brother Record Company, because Tweety had suddenly made a big hit in Paris, in France. So there was a TV superstar movie compilation that was doing big business, and then there was a record. They put out a Tweety record, it's called Tweety there. And so they came over and took these shots.
I have that little statue you're holding there.
You have,
yeah.
Have you got the one on the cage or the one on the floor?
The one on the floor.
Yeah. And this Tweety's got his, the little record actually that's in there is on his head there.
Uh-huh.
That's the cover. And this actually it won a gold record or two. Now here's Carl and I were the ones that wrote the very first version of the I Taught I Taught Putty Tat song, and that's Carl shown at the piano, where he actually wrote that and the other scores for us. He'd sit with his hand on the fingers and figure it out and write the hit the notes and write it down on the music score. This just gives you a quick glimpse of how we did our recordings. We had a 40-piece orchestra, Paul, and up to 60 on occasion at Warner's.
Those singers, too.
And those singers were some of our gang at the studio, some of the animators and Ink and Pink girls that were good, and they'd practice at noontime, then we'd use them on the picture. We also, of course, used the Sportsman Quartet and people like that, see. And over here you'll see Leon Schlesinger and Carl Stalling and Craig Brown, the sound man, who was so great on the sound effects. Couple more shots. This is up from the booth. This is the same booth where I used to sit and watch him record the music for the Humphrey Bogart and the pictures and the musicals and so forth. Errol Flynn, Betty Davis. He'd mix it up there, and you can see the orchestra is separated so that the microphones pick up the woodwinds and the other things. They're all got a separate mic on
them.
That's Carl just starting to lead the orchestra at the beginning of a recording. The music was going right there. And that's Trey Brown again sitting down there at his elbow.
And that changed through the years too, that theme song, quite a bit. I mean,
yes.
The sound of it.
Yes. And of course, originally, Harvin Isaac originally had something like Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight on the Looney Tunes or Merry Melodies. And there was a time when there would be different songs. Like on the Looney Tunes, there was the Merry-Go-Round Broke Down. We used that for a period. But once Carl got the special orchestration of this one, which was actually called, it was a Broadway show tune, actually, you see, but he gave a special orchestration to it. And it's known as the Merry Melody Song. They don't even remember it was on a Broadway musical.
Yeah.
This was happened to be the first Dr. Seuss color cartoon ever made, which I made Horton Hatches the Egg. And on that one, I actually went out and got the rights myself, Paul. The studio wouldn't pay for it when I promoted the rights.
And your company did this?
Not my company. I was under contract to Warner's. I went to Leon and I said, hey, this wonderful book that I would love to make as a film, can I do it? He says, sure, you know. Then he says, but I can't pay any money on it. I couldn't pay for the rights, you see. But if you can arrange for it without me having to pay anything, go ahead. And as it was, I wrote Dr. Seuss, and he put me in touch with Random House. I still have the letter I wrote them, and eventually they gave me the rights. What I told him is, I said, gee, Leon can't pay because he just pays so much to his writers.
So you got temporary rights?
I got the rights for this one film, in perpetuity for this one film. And the interesting thing was that what I said to them was, hopefully, if people across America see it in the theater, and everybody used to go to the movies then.
I have this record at home.
Have you?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's in a good story, isn't it?
I collect records too, yeah.
Terrific.
I have the book and the record, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. You got that original book, the one mainly drawings on white paper, just two tones of color.
It's like a green color on the outside or something.
Yeah. That's great. Somebody's saving those, Paul.
Well, I should bring it in and have you sign it now.
Well, get Dr. Seuss to sign it.
Yeah.
And anyway, then later Sylvester was developed. It shows from no characters at all, you know, to finally Porky, and then Yosemite Sam developed. And that was actually, the first idea for that was based on a Red Skelton cowboy character that he had on the show.
Huh.
This is a drawing I made a couple of years ago for the Pittsburgh Pirates, their baseball team's cover, you know, their yearbook. I was back in Pittsburgh speaking, and I was kidding them about their pirate insignia, which was a kind of a square-looking guy, you know, with a pirate's hat on. And they said, yeah, you got a better idea? And I said, well, sure, Yosemite Sam would be a better pirate insignia. And they laughed, and then about a month later, they called me, and they said, hey, you know, we thought that maybe is an idea after all. And I arranged it with the Warner people.
When I go to swap meets, I see these things appear up all the time as car mats. And not only car mats, but truckers use them as mud flaps.
Yeah, as mud flaps.
Uh-huh.
Terrific.
And Roadrunner as well.
Oh, Roadrunner, real popular. You see the Roadrunner sticker on a lot of cars.
Yeah.
Anyway, going back a few years now, we've gone up to about 1944 there, 45, but going back to 1935 and 6, Paul, was when I was helping Tex with the Porky's at Termite Terrace. I had this idea, actually a little before that, to do try to do something fantasy like, you know, realistic people and imaginative animals and so forth. And so I got the idea of doing Edgar Rice Burroughs' Mars stories. And to make a long story short, I went to him, and he said, "Well, let's see, you know, can you do it? Can you make it look right?" So just working at nights for about a year, and a few of the guys in the studio helped me part of the time, and I made this test film, see, and for him, and he took it to MGM, and MGM, by the summer of '36, they said, "Yes, we want it. We want a series of Mars stories." So I was all set to start my own studio at that time, to go out as an independent producer and working in, you know, concert with the rights from him. It was all set. And anyway, before I tell you the final upshot of how I ended up staying at Warner's, I have a little footage here, a little bit of the stuff that was found at the Tarzana warehouse where some of it had burned and so forth. And I thought you might get a little kick to see a little bit of the sales film. So we just run that now.
Sure.
This was before Snow White was done, so we had nothing to go by, you know, too well as how people would be animated.
Sure, I love that.
Can you
want to
show the other two first?
Yes, I'll show the other couple of slides. These were just little thumbnail sketches, you know, trying to figure out what rocket ships would look like. See, there were no rocket ships then. Uh-huh. And this actually was drawn by Burroughs' son, John Coleman Burroughs, see, who was a very fine artist, and a guy that he and I went to Otis Art School together, and as kids, and I didn't know at that time that he was Burroughs' son, you know, we just became good friends. But anyway, later, when I went back to Burroughs, Jack was off in college or something, but he called Jack in then, and then Jack worked with us on it, and he would make these original sketches of how his dad visualized the anatomy of his characters. He'd give that to me with the color suggestions, and I would transfer that to the animated technique, like this, you see, and then animate it, and then put background in. Of course, for 1936.
So it's like some of the stuff right now that's popular. You know, all that space stuff is coming back, and it looks a lot like this.
Well, if we'd have done it then, see, we would have been doing Star Wars almost way back at that time. So anyway, the shots I have aren't the complete film at all, but we have a few of the color films and some of the pencil tests, a shot of Burroughs and us working on the film and so forth.
Great,
so,
great. So, that should be
fun. Here we go. This is just silent. This was the little introducing. Other direction, Sody. That's Edgar Rice Burroughs. I'm Eddie's typewriter.
Now, you say a lot of this was destroyed in a fire?
Yeah, they had borrowed the negative from me because they were trying to revive it, and they had it in their warehouse over there. Some of the early Tarzan films that were on nitrate started a fire and burned up some of their stuff in their warehouse. So they had all of, they saved every drawing, every oil painting, every film, every everything. Sometime, if you like, I'll take you over there and then go through the warehouse.
That'd be so fun, God.
Yeah. But anyway, this is a shot we took at this. So, Sody, let's get it in focus and then go back and show it. It's not in focus yet. Well, don't worry about it. Just play with it until you do. So, in other words, this is a shot of Burroughs right at his typewriter where he wrote practically all those Mars and Tarzan books, see?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now you want me to go back?
Yeah, go back and let Paul see. That's Burroughs. That is typewriter. That's the way he writes his script. Sometimes he dictates them into the dictaphone, the girl would type it. So, this was just shot to say, hey, here's how it's done. Burroughs writes the stories and we animate it. It's just kind of a little pumped up publicity sales film.
For sure, use it.
Then give him an idea of all the things that he's got out. A shot from one of the early pictures.
track. There were so many different Tarzans.
Yeah. And so with battery good, the Tarzan still goes big, you know. Look at this fake leopard here, too. So, now, this is actually a shot of John Coleman painting one of the backgrounds for the final picture. And we're working on the musical score. This is John's wife helping us ink and paint the coats. And that's my hand there. See the Donald Duck doll? That's one of the very, I think, the first or second one. Now, that's my hand there drawing. Of course, I get a little stop motion stuff. And there's John Carter running. And then he's dueling his villain here. Could be Darth Vader with a little extra tin blade.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
And put some lights on the swords, you know, some... But they were astounded with that animation at the time because they hadn't... here comes Mars, the opening title. Big music, boom, into the camera.
They had never seen something so human.
No, never had. And see, we try to get away from cartoon outline. You see more, we painted shadow sides on it and so forth. Mm-hmm. Here's the boat run. And they clapped when they saw that at that time. They applauded over at MGM.
It was wild.
And see, we did that with oil paints. That's the swinging into the camera. Okay, back to the... back to the...
Glad you showed that to me.
Wait a minute.
Okay.
Here.
Now, this is a shot taken at the Burroughs office where he wrote most of his things more recently, of course. This is his family here. This is his two sons, John Coleman and Hulbert, and his grandson, who's sort of half running the business now. And these are some of the things that John and I made up, mainly John. A Thark head is a head. And this is John Carter's sword and scabbard. And these are some of John Coleman's paintings here, like that's of his father there.
This almost looks like some of the posters that are coming out now.
Yes, yeah.
So yeah, the ones I'm speaking of.
I know what you mean. And so they were really, Burroughs was so far ahead, his imaginative stuff was so far ahead. If we'd have made that series, I was going, you know the kind of stuff I did later in Wacky Land in a humorous vein? Mm-hmm. I was going to have, he let me go way past even what the books say about real imaginative animals and backgrounds. It would have really, really been fun.
It looks like your jacket before it got the patches.
It's a second one of the same type, yeah. Now this is Mimi Littell. Mimi Littell, I lived with her and her family when I was a youngster. And she was a costume designer for Cecil B. DeMille when she was a teenager. Hmm. Her father was an art director. I'll tell you more about them later. But she used to, when I was a kid, she used to help me make up costumes and puppets and stuff. And then
that's the old beanie. Did they turn out an old beanie doll like that?
Where is that?
The beanie.
Now see, Naomi was with us. She was at the studio with us for a number of years as the key puppet maker, and I'd have to check just which this is. You know, we had different versions. This is in 1938. This Paul is my puppet studio across the street from Warner's when I was directing the Porky's and Daffy's. And then I had this puppet studio across the street where I did this film for Bergen, and I also did all these experimental things. And a lot of the stuff that we experimented with there and licked, production methods and facial expressions and way of doing background, scenics fast enough on cardboard instead of building them out of wood.
So this was just like a small room across the street, or was it a whole building?
It was a building. It was a large, I'll show you some other shots of it.
Was it just your venture?
My venture,
How were you able, did you just put a lease on the building or rent the building and just cross your fingers?
I got my uncle.
I'm sure he'll be here most
to put $1,000 up. Everything, it was a depression, you know. Mm-hmm. And I had to go to Leon Schlesinger. He had an exclusive contract with me. And so that said that everything that I thought of or did or anything was his property.
Yeah,
you know, a typical studio contract. So my uncle said, well, you better have a lawyer talk to him. So we went to Leon, and I said, I've got this idea of further developing some puppets that I've been working on for years. And I said, and I'd like you to do it. In other words, if what you, you know, what I finished mm-hmm. this film, if mm-hmm. if you like it, maybe you'd like as a new series for the Warner Brothers yeah. film, see? So it ended up that we made up a little agreement where he had the right of first refusal. I could go ahead with this on my own expense. If he liked it, then he had the first right first. I wouldn't take it to MGM or somebody else. If he didn't want to do it, then all rights remained with me. Mm-hmm. I was lucky I did that.
Yeah.
So this was an exciting period here because we developed really the basis of almost everything later that we did on television, you see. Now the next shot shows we did everything from stop motion to combining animation with puppets to using
looks human. Like you have some rear projection going on, perhaps.
We even did a little of that, yeah. Stuff that nobody'd done at that time, uh-huh. you see. This was actually even before George Pal came to this country, you know, to do his puppet tunes. So anyway, the next shot shows my main associate on that really was, I forgot that I'd got the damn thing. You're awake again. His name is Al Kindig, and he was like an assistant animator on my Porky's, and that he worked with me every noon. I'd go over there every night. I'd go over there weekends. We'd go there and we did all this stuff. You see, mm-hmm. Now one of the things we did along with the hand puppets and everything else was we did stop motion. We were trying to develop stop motion. And he and I invented a patent, which is patented in Washington, a way of getting puppets to move as accurately as drawings, you know.
A Gumby.
A Gumby, but Gumby does it kind of ad lib. And I did it by doing animation and making the puppet follow the animation 100%.
Mm-hmm. Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.